Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Simon Phipps joins me. We're going to chat about LiveVirt or LiveVirt, however way you pronounce it. It's a great way to manage your virtual machines. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Simon Phipps, episode 213, recorded June 6th, 2012. LiveVirt. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, Libre, open-source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at StoneAge.com, bringing you as often as I can. Oh, yeah, we skip a week every once in a while. Sorry about that. But as often as we can, we are being weekly, talking about all these great projects, small projects, projects you probably haven't heard of at all, projects you may have heard of or using every day. So I'm usually joined by a wonderful co-host. This week is no exception, Simon Phipps. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Randall. So great to be back on the show again.
Very cool. Very cool. And I'm back in Southern California at my favorite client down here. I'm also back from Bermuda. I was in Bermuda last week on a cruise. If you watch my Flickr stream, you'll start to see some pictures showing up from there. It took like 700, 800 pictures. Now the problem, of course, is filtering those all down. That was a lot of fun. And again, sorry about last week's cancellation. It's entirely my fault. I missed a piece of email that came in that said that the guest wouldn't be able to be there. We will get him back on. It was Apache Software Foundation, I believe. And we will get him back on in the schedule for Q3. More about that at the end of the show. But this week's guests are here. We're standing by, ready to go. We've got Guido Gunther, who is, and Eric Blake. They are working on the LiveVirt or LiveVirt project. I guess it depends on who you are, whether you say live or lib. And LiveVirt, from what I can tell, is a library but sits between application layers and all of the VM technologies like QEMU and KVM, and I don't have it in front of me, but all the things that basically make virtual machines. So do you know anything about this? What do you know about LiveVirt, Simon?
I know absolutely nothing about it. You know, we've had a sequence of these sessions about cloud hosting and virtualization, and this is a technology I really hadn't realized existed. So it's going to be very interesting to talk to them about it.
Very cool. Very cool. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. And I know that's part of the stack of, you know, I want to thank Justin for sending me all these wonderful guests that relate to various things that Red Hat is helping to fund and helping to sponsor. And this is yet another project from Justin. So thank you again for that. But before we get into our guests, I have a very important announcement. As soon as I pull up my preview screen, there we go. Okay, so this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Netflix. Netflix streams thousands of TV episodes and movies directly to you, instantly, which means you save time, money, and hassle. There are several easy ways to instantly access streaming movies and TV shows with Netflix. You can watch Netflix movies and TV shows on your Mac or PC or iPad. And I, in fact, was in my hotel room last night watching Netflix on my laptop. I really appreciate being able to do that. You can also watch on your iPhone and some Android phones as well. If you have a gaming console like an Xbox 360, a PS3, or a Nintendo Wii, you can watch Netflix right on your TV. If you're not a gamer, you can watch Netflix on your TV with an Apple TV box or a Roku box. I have the latest generation Roku. It works very nice on there. Inexpensive and easy to use. With Netflix, you can watch movies and TV shows instantly using any of these devices. And you can begin watching a movie or show on one device and then finish on a different one. Whichever ways you choose to access Netflix, you can watch as many movies and TV shows as you want, anytime you want, and you can cancel anytime. So try Netflix today for 30 days for free. Go to netflix.com/twit. That's T-W-I-T. Be sure to use this URL when you sign up for your free trial, netflix.com/twit. We thank Netflix for their support of Twit and Floss Weekly, and we hope you enjoy watching instantly with Netflix. And now let's go ahead and bring on our guests. Let's first speak with Guido Gunther, I guess. I've got to mistype on my screen here. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, actually. And where are you speaking to us from?
I'm speaking to you from Germany. It's becoming evening here right now, and I'm glad to be on.
Very good. And you're even further east than our other co-host here. So that's pretty cool. Let's also bring on our other guest. That would be Eric Blake. Eric, welcome to the show.
Hello. Glad to be here.
Great, great. And where are you speaking to us from?
I'm calling in from Salt Lake City, Utah.
Ah, just a little east of me. Well, actually somewhat east of me. I was actually in Salt Lake City for a whole half hour on Sunday. So very familiar with the airport there, let's put it that way. So let's start with Guido. Let's talk with Eric. Eric's probably the best person to answer this question. I gave a sort of brief overview of Libvirt at the beginning of the show, but I probably did a pretty poor job of it because I haven't had a lot of time to study what this is all about. So why don't you give us sort of the 30,000-foot view of what Libvirt's about and what problem it solves?
All right. Libvirt is a virtualization glue library. The goal is to provide a stable API that applications higher up in the stack can be used to manage multiple hypervisor technologies. Hypervisors being things like Xen, KVM, LXC for Linux containers, even into some of the proprietary hypervisors, Microsoft Hyper-V, VMware, has an ESX solution. All of those have been ported to the Libvirt management layer so that Libvirt has a common API to manage an XML representation of here's what it takes to fire my guest, my virtualization guest. And then upper layer software can use the common API to start and stop guests, take snapshots, manage resource allocations, allocate files to be used by the guest. Basically, any operation that is useful for managing a virtual machine, Libvirt tries to provide that.
Cool. And what's your relationship with the product? Project.
I'm working as a core developer. I've been with Red Hat for about 2 years, and during that time, I started straight out on Libvirt. Started out as learning the source code, and now I'm one of the top contributors. Provide a lot of the reviews on open source. Anybody in the community that wants to contribute.
Okay, and Guido, same question. What's your relationship to the project?
I'm doing the Debian packages. So a couple of years ago, I stumbled across Libvirt when I was looking for some tool which allowed me to manage either Xen or KVM instances. And so I found Libvirt and contributed some patches and started the Debian packaging and did this since then. And I'm using this in various installations at customer sites.
And so what would a typical user use this for? What's the end goal of the problem that this is solving?
There are several things, actually. So this goes from complete cloud solutions. I think OpenStack is using it and other things like OpenNebula are using it. And it also goes to just having some test machines on your desktop and just testing a new Linux distribution with e.g. Programs like GNOME Boxes or Virt Manager. So it's the whole spectrum.
Okay. And so what's the difficulty in the difference between the API? I mean, why would we need this library that abstracts it? Why can't you just call everything directly?
Because there's so many different hypervisors and so many different things to call. The KVM command line is quite complex to manage. The monitor commands are very kind of complicated, and they might change between versions, and they are not guaranteed to be long-term stable. And so the Libvirt API just abstracts these things away and handles different versions of QMU and different versions of KVM. And it basically looks the same to me if I want to start a Xen instance or if I want to start a KVM instance.
Now, the lib in Libvirt makes it sound like it's a library. Is it just a library,
yes,
or are there some command line interfaces to it?
It's a C library, and there's a tool coming with it called Virsh, which basically implements all the library calls as a command line tool, so you can just do all the things on the command line, and it also ships the Python bindings in the library package.
Okay, so it can talk to Python directly.
Yes.
Yeah, and then on top of that, we have bindings for Java, for Perl, for Ruby, I think there's even been a port for PHP. Basically, by making it a library, the goal is to make it so that it's usable by whatever other programming interface you want to program your cloud management in.
Now, in the past shows, we've covered pretty much the entire virtualization stack that Red Hat's working on. How does this fit into all that, or does it?
It is. It's the bottom of the stack. You choose, right now Red Hat is focusing on KVM, but if you look back in history, if you used Red Hat Enterprise Linux 5, that started out with Xen technology. In fact, that's how Libvirt was born, was Red Hat said, we want to move away from Xen and over to KVM. It's the up-and-coming technology. But that means we have to rewrite our entire stack from scratch unless we have a glue layer that stays stable while we swap the back end. So Libvirt was born to make the Xen to KVM switch pain-free.
Cool.
So,
That's
all right, Randall. So I'm kind of interested by this. You've got several different virtualization activities going on in that stack. You've got Libvirt here. Last week we had some folks talking about OpenShift. Before that, we've had people talking about the platform virtualization. With all these virtualization steps in Red Hat stack, isn't that going to introduce performance issues?
Performance is a good question. I think the answer is Libvirt focuses on the management, what it takes to start and stop a domain, what it takes to migrate between one host to another. Performance starts to come in with, once you've got your hypervisor, then let the hypervisor do everything on its own. So the performance of your guest is what can Libvirt provide to tune it. Can you provide resource guarantees to the guest? But once you've provided those guarantees, once your guest has started and running, then Libvirt's more of a passive resource role. Is it still using resources? Is it still running? And not something actively in the... The guest isn't aware that Libvirt's in the stack. So I'm not sure that the resources of starting a guest are on the critical path for what the guest is actually doing.
Right. So you've got this virtualization library. How many other projects are using that? Or is this purely something that Red Hat's using? Is it KVM only, or are there a wide range of projects that are using this this library?
We do have a number of projects built on top of Libvirt that we're aware of. I'm trying to look up a URL from the Libvirt webpage of some of the clients that are there. I know off the top of my head, we have Virt Manager is a graphical front end. Like Guido said, there's the VirtSH command line interface. There's OpenStack is using, I know the VDSM is the, I'm not sure what the acronym stands for, but VDSM is the management software that Red Hat uses as part of OpenStack to manage virtual machines across a cloud of hosts, whereas Libvirt tends to focus on what does it take for Libvirt, or Libvirt focuses on what does it take for a virtual machine on a single host or migrating it to another, and so some of the other pieces like VDSM are built on top. Libvirt.org/apps.html is a good overview of a lot of the different applications that have mentioned using Libvirt over the years.
Right. We'll get somebody to look that up for us. So this Libvirt project, I noticed in the shape of Guido, you've got a Debian committer involved there, and you're from Red Hat. Is this a diverse community working on Libvirt?
Guido, do you want to answer that?
Yes, I'm happy to. Actually, yes, it is. There are people on the project from all Linux distributions, like Fedora, of course, Debian, Gentoo. There are people from all the different hypervisors on the project. So this is kind of one of the fun parts of the project, that there are so many different people involved.
Right. And how do you manage the relationships between them? I mean, what is the governance that you've got for that project? Is it a Git style, he who provides a pull request wins, or is there a more formal governance?
We're not quite as active as the kernel, so it's send your patches to the list, and as soon as somebody reviews it and gives an ACK, your patch is pretty much going to go in. I will say KVM probably gets the lion's share of the patches, if only because Red Hat is using libvirt so heavily, but just this week we had patches for OpenVZ. There have been patches, like I said, Microsoft Hyper-V has even been supported with patches written to port the libvirt APIs to manage the Hyper-V resource. So at the moment, it tends to be pretty open. Whoever submits patches, they'll probably be considered within a few days. Send a ping to the list if you want more attention, and tends to be given.
Right. So you said there that Red Hat is using it heavily for KVM. Does that mean that Red Hat is dominant in the project?
Probably. I would say if we were to look at the Git log, that upwards of 60% of the patches are coming from Red Hat domain names, or people who don't use the Red Hat domain name, but you know that they're associated with Red Hat. But that's not to say Red Hat wants a monopoly on this. We actually want it to be open. We want contributors from, I know a lot of patches come in from Fujitsu and IBM.
Right, right. So how do you manage releases in this sort of project? Do you have a release schedule with a release train, or do you simply have people pulling the latest stable tested build off your hosting system? How do you manage releases?
Good question. Right now, we try to hold releases about every 6 weeks. At one point, we were trying monthly snapshots. That's problem with monthly was turning out that we were getting features written on the last week of the month and then no time to integrate them. So right now it's slowed down to about every 6 weeks, but we are doing a stable point release about every 6 weeks. Our requirement is mandatory that no API is ever withdrawn or broken, only new APIs added or new flags to existing APIs, so what was once an error now works. But we're very careful to make sure that the entire, if you compiled against an older version of the library, then upgrading the library will not change your application. Your application will still work with the older API.
So at this point, would you consider libvirt to be stable and usable and enterprise ready, or are we still ahead of that on the schedule?
Red Hat Enterprise has been using it since RHEL5, so I would say enterprise ready. There's still improvements to be made. We're not at libvirt 1.0, and one of the upstream lists just this month was a what will it take to get to 1.0. A lot of those questions were what new APIs can we exist that are, or can we invent that are ease of use, make it easier than less race prone than the existing APIs. Of course, the existing ones will still exist and will still work. But I think that we will be able to achieve libvirt 1.0 within the next 6 months.
Well, that's sort of curious then. Why did you choose a number that's still below 1.0 if people are using it in enterprise Linux already?
Not my choice. I think it boils down to numbers are arbitrary. The guy who's doing the packaging is Daniel Vaillard, and his opinion is as long as the number's monotonically increasing, who cares what it is?
I have a package in the CPAN that for a number of years has still been below 1.0, and yet it's been in production use on major sites for like 7 years. So I relate. That's why I was curious about the number here for that. Is this strictly Linux, or are there ports of this to other hosting platforms?
Right now, the QEMU support is not just Linux, but x86 hardware, and there's a push to expand it out to PowerPC and ARM architectures. That's the part of Libvirt that actually drives QEMU. Now, the other part of Libvirt is that it is designed for remote management, that you can, from one machine, set up a connection over SSH or over secured a TLS port. We have several encryption backends for the connection. And then from your machine, you do a remote shell into the Libvirt on the actual host and can manage Libvirt remotely. That client part is designed to be run anywhere. We have a port to Windows via the MinGW cross-compiler. Mm-hmm. I know the client is also compiled for at least FreeBSD has a port in their ports repository of the Libvirt client. And there's work underway to make it portable to... I don't know if anybody's tried to build it on Solaris or some of these other systems, but I do know that there is a goal of portability in the code base that it should be compiled, the client part should be compilable anywhere to control your Linux host. And if it's not, patches are welcome.
And so this would only support then Linux guests, or is it just arbitrary? Is it dependent on the virtualization machine?
Definitely depends on the virtualization that you're targeting. If you're targeting Hyper-V, that's a Windows guest. So Windows host, Windows guest, and the way Libvirt targets Hyper-V is by talking the same protocol as the Windows solution does. But being open source, it means you can run a Linux client targeting a Windows host for your Hyper-V guest.
Well, let me be a little more practical here, because this is the real question I was trying to get around to asking. I've got an OS X laptop, and I have a VirtualBox. Is this going to be of any use to me at all?
Absolutely. VBox is one of the supported drivers, and there is Mac ports does have a build of the Libvirt client with a VirtualBox support built in.
Oh, wow. You mean so sudo ports install Libvirt? I probably have it already in about another 30 seconds or so. Nice. Nice. Well, now I know what I'm going to be playing with after the show. I keep forgetting that some of this stuff may actually work other places. So do you know how current the Mac ports version is?
I think that Justin Clift is the person at Red Hat that's been compiling the Mac OS ports. And to my knowledge, every time that there's a upstream Libvirt release, it's within a week that we get an email to the list saying the Mac OS ports is available as well.
And how new is 0.9.10? Is that pretty new?
0.9.10 came out, I want to say, January. The current release is 0.9.12, and 0.9.13 is scheduled for end of June.
Okay.
But it's 0.9.10 is what shipped with Red Hat 6.2.
Okay, so it'd still be usable. I could still install it and at least play with it then.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, okay, I know what I'm doing after the show then. That's great. What is it written in? You said C. Is it just one big C package, or is there some Python bindings as well? Or I mean, what's the size of this code base? I'm also looking for things like that.
Libvirt itself is primarily C. Like you said, there are Python bindings as part of the official Libvirt. Bindings for the other languages like Perl and Ruby are separate packages, so I don't have as good a feel for the size of those other packages. I'm going to check on the size of the latest tarball to see a rough size. I don't know that that's an indication of lines of code or anything, but I think we're into the hundreds of thousands of lines of code by now, if only because we're supporting a vast array of different virtualization technologies.
Actually, I have some packaging questions. Let's talk to Guido for just a second. What's involved in making something like this packaged up properly? I guess I'm sort of fleshing around because I haven't done anything looks like packaging before.
Well, first of all, it's a library, so you have to get things like the symbol versioning right. And so in order to be sure, you keep the backwards compatibility. And Libvirt has quite some external dependencies because it does things like network management with a library called NetCF, and it does storage management with LVM and iSCSI and all these things. And so this basically involves just getting all the dependencies right and detecting them and packaging this all together. After all, it's not that complicated because the daemon is quite stable and ships with sane init scripts and all these things. So it's not that complicated of a package. And Upstream is actually very friendly in accepting patches that make porting it easier. So that's actually quite nice.
Cool. And so I understand that some of the recent contributions seem to be on guest snapshots and storage management. So why are guest snapshots useful?
Guest snapshots lets you take a picture of your virtual machine at the state it was in, then proceed to make other changes. And if you change your mind, oh, I wish I hadn't installed this because it broke everything, go back to your snapshot, rewind history. Start over from a stable point. It makes it possible to do thin provisioning where you say, install my bare bones guest, get it all the security patches in, take a snapshot, now create a bunch of clones, all starting from that snapshot. And guess what? I don't have to install the security patches because they're all installed based on that snapshot. There's a lot of power in taking known points in time of one guest and then being able to use that to replicate to other guests or being able to rewind to that point in time.
Cool. I've got to actually say, I'm actually reading these list of questions that you sent me before the show. it's no secret that behind the scenes we do a little bit of this kind of don't have any new research because we have our guests do the research for us. So what does SVIRT mean?
SVIRT stands for Secure Virtualization. One of the goals in writing Libvirt was to say, we want to isolate our guests. If you're going to run an unknown operating system, you don't want it leaking. You don't want operating system run by user A to corrupt the files on your host or even the files of the guest running on operating system B. You want to sandbox your guests so that they can't do anything to anything else on your system. SVIRT is coupling the SE Linux security extensions that are in Fedora and Red Hat Linux and setting up a security policy where every guest has resources labeled with a different SE Linux label. At that point, the kernel guarantees, the host kernel guarantees that even if there's a flaw, a buffer overrun in QEMU, or whatever else that the guest is able to escape the sandbox, it still can't do any damage to the rest of your system because it can only damage the files with its generated label, and Libvirt took care to generate a unique label for every instance of a guest.
Cool.
So there's some fascinating features in this software. What features are missing, would you say, from Libvirt at the moment?
I know that we're trying to work on a feature of finer-grained access control lists. Right now, Libvirt is an all-or-nothing. If you can talk to the Libvirt D daemon, you can start up a guest of your own choosing with a file name of your own choosing. I'll choose etsy password is the file that's backing my guest, and now my guest can overwrite the passwords of the host. And because I'm trusted to talk to Libvirt D, you have to trust me that I meant to do that. Not very secure. I mean, SVIRT does make it secure so that if you don't pass in a bogus file name, you can't corrupt it. But it's trusting the administrator quite a bit. So one of the projects is finer-grained permissions that says not only do I have to connect to Libvirt D, but I have to authenticate which actions am I permitted to do once I'm connected. So it may be possible that I'm permitted to query resources am I using? Am I going to run out of disk space? But to say at the same time, I'm not allowed to start a new guest unless I'm user with extra credentials XYZ. So there's improved security through improved permissions. Another project that I'm personally working on is better storage management. Right now, you can take snapshots, but there's no way using libvirt to undo those snapshots. And part of that's because QEMU doesn't yet have a way to undo snapshots, but other hypervisors do, like ESX does have a way to undo snapshots. So libvirt should be able to expose more features with what snapshots can do, make it more flexible, make it so that when you're managing your system of snapshots, that it's that libvirt gives you all the tools in the library to roll back or to clone one guest from another. So a lot of polished work to what's already there and a lot of enhancements based on where the trends are going in virtualization.
Right, Rand. I've been making notes about that potential exploit, and let me just finish this off. Okay. thank you for the hint. Is there a mobile story to all this? Because you know, everything you've talked about so far has been pretty close to the metal on big computers, and yet all this virtualization technology is making its way out into the mobile and personal device world now. Is that one of the dimensions of your future?
I think so. Like I said earlier, there's efforts underway right now to say, can we run libvirt, at least the client aspect, can we run the client aspect on an ARM or a PowerPC machine so that you can pull out your smartphone, open up your favorite shell or your favorite GUI built on top of libvirt, and the GUI says, connect to my remote bare metal server rack space in some colo and turn on my virtual machine. Having libvirt be the support remote connections is already there, but having applications built on top of that support, those applications can be ported to a mobile environment so that you can do more of your management from whatever machine you happen to be on. You don't have to be on the big, beefy machine actually running your guests, but you can manage it from your local machine, even if that's a smartphone.
Right.
And it would probably be nice if one could set up containers on your mobile device so you can put applications with maybe LXC, like you have your tablet and you have other containers running on it because the resources are enough, and libvirt could probably handle that on your tablet or mobile phone as well, as long as it runs a regular Linux kernel and supports LXC.
Right.
LXC is definitely one of the current technologies where libvirt is looking into. I mean, it's not quite the same as KVM for running a complete OS, but there's a recent project built on top of libvirt with libvirt sandbox that says, what's the bare minimum I can do to spawn an LXC container that runs, say, a web browser or any other application that I don't trust in its own container, and wrap that all nicely into a libvirt package.
Right. So now, what I noticed that you're using GNU AutoConf. What's your relationship with the GNU project?
My personal relationship, before I was on libvirt, I became the GNU AutoConf maintainer. So I do have a severe background in being a polyglot, if you will call it that. AutoConf is one of those projects where you write a Perl script that manages the M4 macro language to develop a portable shell script that tells you what C program features you can use. If you don't know all four languages, good luck. But the nice part about AutoConf is it's part of what gives libvirt the ability to compile on Mac OS, the ability to compile for MinGW for Windows, to compile on FreeBSD by isolating all of the compatibility aspects into your configure checks up front.
Right. I've heard that it has something of a love-hate relationship with many developers on free software, though. Do you not worry that you're using a technology that's going to discourage contribution?
I don't know if it discourages contribution so much as either you know how to use it or it's a pile of black magic. And I think that's where the hate relationship comes in. It's not doing what I want, but I don't know how to figure out how to make it do that. And for AutoConf, that's, I don't know. My personal time as being one of the maintainers, I've tried to help ease that relationship and answer questions and make it easier to use, if only by the documentation efforts. But I will say that for package maintainers, and maybe Guido can correct me, but packages that use AutoConf are infinitely easier to port to a new system. And the fact that so many packages use AutoConf is a testament to, even if it's hard for the developer to use, the end result makes it much easier for everybody else to use the package that used AutoConf.
Okay, so I think actually, if I'm not mistaken, AutoConf came from the Perl project, right?
There's two different AutoConfs. Perl has one with a capital A. I'm talking about GNU AutoConf, which is, I think that predated Perl. It stemmed from, I don't know if it was late 80s or early 90s, but in an effort to, when the GNU coding standards were first written by Richard Stallman, saying, here's what a GNU package should do. And AutoConf was written to say, well, how do we write the configure script that does that? And it took off in popularity because it could be used to configure even software that's not related to GNU. Libvirt's not owned by the Free Software Foundation. And it definitely had its roots in Red Hat and not in GNU.
Okay.
And it's not branded as a GNU project, but it uses AutoConf because it makes it much easier to ship a package that has the same behavior as every other package out there than it is to do all the package management from scratch.
Yeah, definitely. Well, we're almost out of time. Is there any last things you want to make sure our audience is aware of? I'll go with Eric first.
I don't know if there's any other questions. I mean, I will say, put out my developer's hat plug, that patches are welcome. Anybody that wants to join the development effort, Libvirt is a pretty relaxed project right now. There's, I found it a lot easier than the kernel to get patches. My first patches to Libvirt, I wrote them and they were accepted within a week or so of my first submittal. And my first patches to the kernel went through a lot more hammering of, you're not following protocol, resubmit. And then from the aspect of, the more people that use it and patch it, the better it'll be. So you're welcome to join. We'll take it.
And what kind of technologies do people have to know to be able to help?
Any virtualization technology that you want. I know, like I said, I focus on QEMU KVM because that's what I use working with Red Hat and working on Fedora. But the fact that we even have VMware and OpenVM, Hyper-V, ESX, the fact that we have 9 or 10 different virtualization technologies supported is because there's 9 or 10 different people all with their own area of interest. If you know the C programming language, and if you know how to say, here's the libvirt guarantee of an operation that's useful, and here's how I would write the glue to map it into my technology to do the same thing, that's really what it takes for libvirt.
Cool. And Guido, same question.
Maybe this kind of matches what Eric said. So, and if you want to know how well a hypervisor is supported, there's another project which is called the Libvirt Technology Compatibility Kit, Libvirt TCK, which kind of has a set of tests which uses a real hypervisor and the Libvirt API to test which API calls are basically supported, and you get a quite nice overview what works and what doesn't.
Cool. All right. Well, I want to thank both of you guys. I'm sorry we're running out of time, but I want to thank both of you guys for coming on and talking about LiveVert. And I think there's now a lot more people aware of it. And hopefully we get some new contributions as well. So thank you guys.
You're welcome. Thanks. Glad to be here.
Great.
Thank you very much.
I stopped in there, Guido. That was Guido Gunther and Eric Blake representing the LiveVert project. What do you think, Simon?
Well, it's been interesting as the weeks have gone by to go further and further down the stack towards the point where LiveVert comes in. And I hadn't really realized that this capability existed for there to be yet another virtualization layer on top of the hardware like that. So I'm going to be quite interested to see what it does. Now, while I know why we've been recording that you've been installing it, how's it going for you so far then?
I had to install about 7 other packages, and actually my video is getting choppy, so I'm going to have to stop it for a second. It just finally got up to LiveVert, and it is compiling LiveVert right now. So that's let me stop it because it's not going to finish before we get down here. How do I stop it? There we go. Okay, now hopefully my video gets back to normal. Just speaking about AutoConf for a while, you know, one of the things I liked about AutoConf is that it does enable you to create configure scripts for just about everything. The downside is configure isn't the right way to go when you're trying to build 40 different packages, because it's the same configure script, well, the slightly variant configure script, have to run over and over and over again to figure out exactly the same things. Do I have a 3 arg open? Do I have this? And yet they're all having to start from scratch on their knowledge base. We had a CMake on the show a while back, and that was great because CMake had the knowledge all baked in for your particular application, so it would just simply do the right thing with a special kind of make file. But has that been your experience, Simon, or do you have a challenge for that?
I haven't touched that area of programming for quite some time now, but I do remember that the more effort that was involved in making your build system, the more likely it was that things were going to go wrong. And that approach does sound brave, I have to say.
Well, cool. Well, I'm glad these guys got a chance to get on. Those of you watching the live feed know that we actually had a bit of a struggle to get everything all set up today. So that's why we didn't have much time left for them to be on the show, and I apologize there. We do this show live, and we never know what's going to happen next, so that's always kind of fun. Speaking of which, we do this show live at 9:30 a.m. on Wednesdays, and you can actually watch us at live.twit.tv, and there's a chat room that goes along with that, and you can actually ask questions. We took a couple questions from the channel this time. But as a matter of scheduling change, starting next month, our July 11th show, we're moving back to 8:30 in the morning, not 9:30 in the morning, so that'll make it a little bit easier for you guys coming in from the U.K., and all that. It'll make it a little bit different for me because I'll have to get up even earlier on Wednesday mornings than I have already. I usually get to sleep in slightly on Wednesday mornings. We have a couple of guests still scheduled for Q2, but I'm going to start my Q3 bookings soon. I said that last week and the week before, but soon, because we're going to run out of guests if I don't. Next week we have LibreOffice. Simon, you want to talk about that for a second?
Yeah, so we've got two of the directors of the Document Foundation coming on next week. We have Charles Schultz from France and Michael Meeks from here in the UK. And they'll be talking about LibreOffice. LibreOffice was a project that started nearly 2 years ago now as a fork of OpenOffice.org and kept on development of OpenOffice.org while the future of that project was uncertain. And they've been doing some great work in keeping the code up to date, adding new features. I just saw today that they've added support for Microsoft Publisher in the next version in 3.6 of LibreOffice. So it's going to be really interesting to talk to them both about that and also about their plans for a browser-based web version and also for LibreOffice on the Android operating system. So very promising and interesting show coming up next week, recording next Wednesday. And I'll be hosting that because I believe that you are... Randall.
I'm at a conference, yes. I'm going to be at YAPSE North America next week. In fact, I was just going to mention that I'll be in Madison, Wisconsin next week for YAPSE. So if you're in that area, watch my tweets, and I'll probably do some sort of tweet up there at least one of the evenings. I'm carless, so I have to be someplace I can either walk to or get a ride to. Following that, coming up about another month after that, I'll be in OSCON, the open source conference in Portland, Oregon. So I get to actually stay close to home, which will be sort of nice. Virtual home, anyway, so that's how how it is for me these days. In the following week, I'll be at Fizzlay in Porto Alegre. I've been accepted there as a guest speaker with one of the international cool people. Once again, that'll be kind of fun. And I'll be in Rio the week following Fizzlay. So there'll be 3 weeks in a row where I'll be out and about somewhere, and I'll have to have y'all take over for me on those shows coming up for Floss Weekly. Let's see. And so, Simon, where else can we find out about you?
Well, I'm still writing a column for InfoWorld every Friday, which I'd love all of your viewers and listeners to go along to and tell IDG they love, because that keeps the bills paid. June is a very quiet month for me. I've got a trip to Paris and would love to see folks over in Paris. But then in July, I'm also going along to OSCON. I have a talk on behalf of the Open Source Initiative, and OSI will be launching a new personal membership scheme there probably. So we'll be very pleased to get some new personal members. Just before OSCON, I'm hoping to go along to the Community Leadership Summit, which is also in Portland, Oregon. And then I've got a pretty quiet August. And then in September, I've signed up for giving the keynote at the International Conference on Open Source Systems in Tunis. So if you're going to be in any of those places, in Portland, Oregon, in Tunis, or in Paris, then get in touch with me. Otherwise, do visit webmink.com, where you'll find links to all the things that I'm writing for Computer World and for Info World, and you'll find links to other activities such as the recordings for Floss Weekly. I think that's all the plugs for this week, Randall.
Great, Simon. Thanks again for being the co-host on this show, and thank you for taking on the role of host for next week. I really appreciate that.
I'm looking forward to it, actually. It's be good to interview Michael and Charles about what they're doing. And I'll be thinking of you toughing it out of that conference.
Oh, yeah. You know, YAPSIs are always so crazy anyway. It's just a tough deal to have all the time. But enough about that, because we're running up out of time here. And I just want to say we'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.